Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the vast liberal conspiracy. Tom Hartman here with you Friday morning, first hour of our program, as always. The man who, in my opinion, represents all of America. He's not a Republican, he's not a Democrat, he's the independent from Vermont, Senator Bernie Sanders. I think of him as America's senator. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, the first hour of the program, and Bernie will be taking your calls right after the first break, and that's what we'll do for the whole rest of the hour at 1-866-440-8466. Tom Hartman here with you, by the way, and welcome to the program. Bernie Sanders, welcome.
Tom, it is very good to be with you.
It's always great to have you on, Bernie. Bernie, what's on your plate this week?
Well, there are a lot of obviously very important developments in Washington right now. The president has proposed his budget, which to my mind is a disaster. It's the same old, same old. Huge tax breaks for the very wealthiest people in this country, while at the same time slashing programs or eliminating programs that benefit the middle class, working families, or lower income people. I'm a member of the budget committee, and we're going to take a very, very hard look at this budget. And I think the real challenge that the Congress faces is, does it have the courage to take on the wealthy and the powerful and say, excuse me, at a time when we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any nation, any major nation on earth, at a time when we're seeing an increase in hunger, at a time when we have a major crisis in affordable housing, when middle-class families can't afford to send their kids to college, when 48 million Americans, including many children, have no health insurance, is it really appropriate to maintain huge tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires? Is that really what we should be doing? And obviously, I think the answer is no, but we're going to need some real grassroots activity to give some spine to members of the House and Senate who are very afraid of the right wing and presidential attacks that will come, that they're raising taxes. They're raising taxes.
Yeah. You know, that's such an important point, Bernie. I played a clip from Russ Feingold yesterday where he was calling on people, on the people of America. He said, this isn't going to happen unless the people of America get active. And you say this every week, and it just can't be said enough.
Was Russ talking about the war or?
I frankly don't remember the issue, but it's not us guys in the Senate. It's you guys out there on the streets.
Look, here it is. I mean, you got people in the Senate and in the House who are, I believe, prepared to do the right thing. But if what they have got to do in the Senate and the House, what we have got to do is stand up to very powerful people who contribute a lot of money, who have enormous influence. And what, you know, some of the moderates and some of the more conservative Democrats are looking at is, my God, if I stand up to big money, they're going to be advertising against me, they're going to be contributing to my opponent and so forth and so on. And if those folks know that grassroots America is prepared to stand up and say, this is absurd. You know, Tom, you and I have discussed this before. It is, one of the great absurdities of our time is this effort to repeal the estate tax.
Yeah.
And the Republicans have done a very good job in framing it as the death tax. How unfair. Meanwhile, this is a tax that benefits, that if it is repealed, benefits the wealthiest 0.2% of the American people. 0.2%. We're talking about $700 billion over a 10-year period. And there are people saying, oh my goodness, I have to vote to repeal this. Really? We don't have enough money for our kids. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty. We have the middle class shrinking. We have people in this country who are sleeping out on the streets, and people say, oh, I have to repeal $700 billion in benefits for the wealthiest, give them $700 billion for the wealthiest 0.2%. This is pretty crazy to my mind.
Yeah.
But we have got to involve ordinary Americans in standing up for a new set of priorities in this country, priorities which benefit the working families of America, the middle class, lower income people, and stop this business of bending over backwards day after day for the wealthiest people. They don't need any help. The wealthiest people in this country today, in terms of income distribution, have not had it so good since the 1920s, just before the Depression. They have seen a huge increase in their wealth. They're seeing a huge increase in their income. Bush has lowered their taxes. Hey, enough is enough. Let's have government work for all of the people, not just the very few on top.
So how specifically do we bring that about, Bernie?
Well, we're going to have a big budget resolution that's coming up. And the question is, are we going to repeal the tax breaks that were given to millionaires and billionaires, use that funding for deficit reduction, and to make sure that our veterans have the health care that they need, that we adequately fund special education so that school districts all over this country have the help they need? That's what it's about. It's a question of priorities, and that process is just beginning. The way it works is the president presents his budget. He did that. It goes to the Budget Committee, of which I am a member, and the House that will be dealing with it as well. And our job is to rewrite that budget. And the key issues here are twofold. If we're serious about funding the needs of the middle class and working families and creating a more egalitarian society, you've got to go after those tax breaks, in my view, for the millionaires and billionaires. Number two, the president has sent us a huge increase in defense spending. And we've got to take a very hard look at that budget as well for a couple of reasons. Number one, for those of us who want to end the war in Iraq and want to go beyond non-binding resolutions, we're going to have to start using the budget, A, to try to do what we can, if it's not too late, to stop the escalation of the war, but more importantly, to use the budget to bring our troops home as soon as possible. And I'm working with people like Russ Feingold on that. Thirdly, in terms of the military budget, if, in fact, fighting international terrorism is our most important goal, which I think it is, it's a very serious problem, then what we have to do is make sure that we have the means to do that and that we're not funding weapon systems, for example, that are based on the old Cold War paradigm. And we've got to take a hard look at that military budget. You know, to me, Tom, it is very ironic that in the midst of this the president's surge in Iraq, you may have read that we have soldiers who are knocking on doors in Baghdad, trying to communicate with Iraqi citizens. We don't have translators there with them.
Right.
Yet we are spending billions of dollars on weapon systems that in many ways were designed to fight the old Soviet Union. Yeah.
And the British did not stop the IRA by bombing Belfast.
You got it.
You know, with high-tech bombers.
Right.
They stopped the IRA with good old-fashioned police work.
Not to mention that if you're really serious about taking on Osama bin Laden, you're going to have to deal with the poverty and the misery that exists in many parts of the Muslim world and elsewhere. Make sure that those people understand that we are on their side. Help them build schools. Help them with health care. And deal with their needs rather than just put money into weapons and the military.
Right.
So we have to take a hard look at those two areas. Change the priorities of America. The middle class is shrinking. Poverty is increasing. We've got to make sure that ordinary people get what they are entitled to rather than just people who have lobbyists and incredible power on Capitol Hill.
There was yesterday an announcement, Bernie, by SEIU, Walmart, Center for American Progress, and a few other groups, AT&T, of a coalition that they're forming to at least advance the idea that our health care system is badly broken and needs to be fixed. Is this, in your mind, a ray of light? Is this the beginning of a process that might produce some good?
Don't know. I mean, you know, I'm a little bit suspect of what Walmart has to say.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, our health care system is disintegrating. And we have not only 48 million people without any health insurance. The costs are soaring. We spend twice as much as any other country on earth for health care. And yet so many of our people are not only uninsured, but they are underinsured. I think, myself, that we have got to move toward a national health care program. I'm an advocate of a single-payer system. I think it should be administered at the statewide level. And we're going to be introducing legislation that will allow states to become models of how we can go forward with universal health care. I think that's probably the most effective way to go at this particular moment. We also, obviously, when we talk about health care, have got to deal with the outrage of our people being forced to pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. We've got to begin negotiating lower prices for Medicare Part D. We need a prescription drug reimportation program so that our people don't have to pay any higher prices than our friends in Canada or in Europe do. a lot of work to be done in that area as well.
Yeah, and in the meantime, literally, people are dying in America because of the failure of our system.
This system is so wasteful. It is so bureaucratic. It does not focus on disease prevention. You know, we have an epidemic of obesity, which will lead to diabetes. We have environmental problems. You know, we here in the Northeast in Vermont, our kids are breathing the crap that comes from coal-burning plants in the Midwest.
Yeah.
I mean, those are all the issues that we have to deal with.
Indeed. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, 16 minutes past the hour. Bernie, as always, our phone lines are now totally slammed, so we will be taking your phone calls as soon as we get back from this break for Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
You got to fight for your rights. You can't bury your head in the sand. You got to fight for your rights. You can't just bury your head in the sand. Politics and religious superstition go hand in hand.
And welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. All hour taking your calls. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. If you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com, we'll get you there. Just click live chat up at the top of the page, and you can hang out there. Bernie, ready?
Yep, I'm right here.
Okay, off we go. Rob in Conway, New Hampshire, you are live with Bernie Sanders. Rob in Conway?
Oh, hi. It's
hey, Rob.
It's Kleindoc. I'm also Kleindoc from the chat room. Tom Hartman,
great.
You are the preeminent genius of our times.
Well, bless you, sir. Thank you. But your question for Bernie.
My question for Bernie is this. Is there any way that we can influence the way the Congressional Budget Office reports economic news? We need a reframing here because all the economic news is for the benefit of corporate interests in Wall Street, whereas news that's of interest to real people is more like how many discouraged people are not even seeking jobs anymore.
Rob, you raise a very good point that's not necessarily, though, the Congressional Congressional Budget Office. That would be more within the Department of Labor. But I think there is a tendency in the government to create a rosier picture on economic figures than should be the case. For example, when you define unemployment rate, if somebody is working part-time, not full-time, and wants to work full-time, they are considered employed. If somebody is what is called a discouraged worker and is in an area where unemployment is high and has basically given up looking for work, they are no longer included. If somebody has a PhD and is looking for a job in a certain area consistent with their qualifications but can't find anything close to that, that does not reflect it as well. So I think the general feeling is that unemployment rate is much higher than ordinarily figured, and that other statistics make the economy look a lot better than it really is.
We need like an underemployment rate.
Well, we need to target what really is going on for ordinary people.
Yeah.
And we don't talk about that enough. I was just at a hearing yesterday with the Secretary of the Treasury, who was really quite literally saying the economy is really marvelous. And while it may be marvelous for the CEOs of large corporations, it certainly is not marvelous for the middle class.
Amen. Jeff in San Francisco, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. Hi, Tom. Proud underemployed PhD, speaking with you guys.
That's
anyhow.
So apropos,
for another show.
There's a statistic that's not recorded. Okay.
That's a perfect segue, too.
Anyhow, what I was wondering about is what I believe is the absolutely critical connection between the escalation of war with what I think is going on, Iran, and the connection between the budget. I think that the plan of the Bush administration is actually to start a war with Iran and thereby continue their slashing of benefits for, you know, the regular folks, and also hyperinflate their way out of debt, you know. So because I think that, you know, as Tom has said in the past, the effect of a war with Iran would be economically disastrous and include such disastrous scenarios as hyperinflation. And I just wanted to comment on that.
Okay, well, the budget that the president is asking for is something like $481 billion for the Pentagon, and this is half, a little bit more than half, of the entire discretionary budget of the United States for the coming year. And this ignores many other aspects of the military, including the cleaning up of old bomb factories, maintaining the nuclear weapons arsenal, et cetera, et cetera. And on top of that, of course, is money for Iraq, Afghanistan, and so forth. What we are seeing, picking up on Jeff's point, is a nation which underfunds the needs of its ordinary people. There have been, the president has proposed a major cut in special education when we should be substantially increasing that. That will mean a lower quality of education for our kids, higher property taxes, local taxes all over this country. So we're becoming a nation in which we give tax breaks to the very, very wealthy. We increase military spending, and we say to everybody else, hey, you're on your own. Good luck.
Yeah, and that doesn't work. Susan in Kirkland, Washington, you're live with Bernie Sanders. We have about a half a minute here before I have to take a break.
Okay, I'll try and get this out fast. Good morning, Senator. My question is, I'm sorry to hear about the cut in special ed funding, but as a parent of children that are testing just below gifted or gifted, there's very few programs, and they're very small in the school districts around the country for these kids, and their needs just are not getting met.
Right.
Most of the teachers that I talk to are so busy trying to bring the kids who are struggling up to grade level and to help them that the other end is challenged.
You make a very good point, and the answer is that we have to substantially increase federal aid education. We have to help the gifted kids. We certainly have to help those kids who are struggling. We can do it all, but we can't do it all when we give tax breaks to billionaires and spend more on the military than we should be spending.
Amen, brother. It's 27 minutes. Thank you, Bernie. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. We'll be right back on the Tom Hartman Program. And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, the first hour of every Friday, has been for years, and hopefully will continue to be Senator Bernie Sanders with us, the independent from Vermont, 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Joe in Brookings, Oregon. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, this whole media obsession of Anna Nicole Smith yesterday reminds me of the fact that we just do not have very much diversity in the news media at all, and these so-called news channels are a complete joke. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 needs to be repealed, and repealed right now, and I'd like to see Senator Sanders push that agenda big time. I was wondering what the senator thought of that.
Is this Joe?
Yes.
Joe. Well, you came to the right guy, Joe. Mm-hmm. Actually, we are going to be introducing major Media Ownership Reform Act legislation within the next couple of weeks. And it will deal with some of the issues that you're concerned with and many others. Bottom line here is that what we're seeing in America is fewer and fewer large media conglomerates owning and controlling what the people see, hear, and read. And that is a very, very dangerous trend for those of us who believe that in a democratic society, people should have access to all points of view. And your point that you just made a moment ago about the focus on celebrities rather than substantive issues is certainly one of the major problems that we face as a nation. Increasingly, politics and public policy is being regarded as in a way not different from how we treat Hollywood, and we're making politicians into media stars rather than having our nation engage in the kind of debate that we need to as to how we expand the middle class, how we create a more egalitarian society, how do we bring health care to all of our people. What does it mean that we have an $8.5 trillion national debt? What does it mean that we have a record-breaking trade deficit? We need discussions on those issues rather than on movie stars and making politics into the American idol. So your point is well taken. We're going to fight for to end this increased concentration of ownership in media. We're going to look at minority ownership in media. We're going to go back to what we call the public interest. Now, the airwaves belong to the people. And when they're given over to networks, certain responsibilities should be required of those networks rather than just making as much money as they possibly can. So those are some of the issues that our legislation will be dealing with.
Just to put a period on that sentence, here's a statistic from the Center for American Progress. Last night on their network news, NBC devoted 3 minutes, 13 seconds to Anna Nicole Smith and 14 seconds to Iraq.
Yeah, and it goes... It goes on. I mean, this tragedy regarding the astronaut who was charged with it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is
all a local story.
You know, crime and crime and crime, and rather than treating the American people as intelligent people who want to know how we can address the serious problems facing our country, at the same time as Anna Nicole Smith is on front pages all over this country, major news outlets are cutting back on the number of correspondents they have in Latin America, Africa, other parts of the world. So this is a huge issue that has to be addressed.
Brian in Eureka, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Senator Sanders. A couple of quick points. I've been a registered nurse for over 20 years, 15 years, the last 15 years as a case manager for the Medicaid system. 2 points. As far as this budget goes, I really like you to stick a fork in it and send it back to the White House, because making cuts to Medicare and Medicaid, meanwhile, ripping off Social Security Trust Fund, to me is intolerable. Why 100% of my salary is taxed for Social Security and Medicare, but not others over $90,000, I don't understand that. If we did tax people appropriately, as I am taxed, not only could we fully fund Social Security and Medicare in perpetuity, but it would also cover universal health care. My second quick point is your ideas on letting states model universal health care is really spot on. My program saves untold millions of dollars in properly case managing catastrophically ill and injured Medicaid patients rather than rationing care. We already have the infrastructure in place to handle this type of stuff. And like I said, I think you're on the right track in a Medicare-type system that is administrated by the states for universal health care.
Right. Well, Brian, thank you very much, and congratulations for the very good work that you're doing. And one of the reasons I like states administering single-payer systems is we can learn from each other. You're in California, I believe, and you're doing things differently than Vermont. We can all learn from each other and make breakthroughs that other states can emulate. Some of the points that you made are precisely the points that I raised yesterday with the Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Paulson. The truth is that in terms of Social Security, there is not a major financial crisis, despite what the administration and the president tells us every week. The facts are that Social Security now has enough money to pay out every nickel owed to every eligible beneficiary from between 35 to 45 years. And if we do one simple thing, and that is the point that Brian just made, we do one simple thing, and that is you eliminate the ceiling right now, which is at about $94,000, and you say to Bill Gates and other people that they have to contribute based on their entire income, not at a cap of $94,000, into the system, you know what, Tom, there is no longer a Social Security problem. It's gone. It's over.
Right. It's that simple.
It is that simple. But it requires wealthy people to contribute more into the system, and obviously you have an administration that is far more worried about their needs than the future of Social Security.
Yeah. Eldon, driving in Indiana, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, sir. Tom, I've talked to you several times on the radio. I want to say again how much I appreciate the work that you do.
Well, thank you, Eldon, and thank you for listening to us on Sirius Satellite Radio.
You bet. And I want to say to Bernie that and we desperately need a president in our future, near future, that reflects his beliefs and feelings. We had Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton was, I think, sort of a compromise, and he was good, but man, we need him or Russ Feingold or someone that that will rescue America and save America from the neocon beliefs.
Thank
you.
Well,
thank you, Elton. And what we need is a president who understands that the vast majority of the people in our country, the middle class, working families, lower income people, are hurting, are not benefiting from the new economy. And we need a president who is going to have the courage to stand up to the multinational corporations and the wealthy special interests that exert so much power in Washington today in almost every single way. And we need a president who is going to mobilize grassroots America to fight for the future of our country, to fight for our kids, and to fight for our parents. And, you know, there's a catch-22 here. As ordinary people stand up, you're going to have politicians becoming more aggressive and bolder. And it goes the other way as well. So that's what we need, I think, in the White House.
Yeah, I think you're one of the few senators who's not running for president. I'm one of the few talk show hosts who will never run for Senate. So here we are. Jim in Grand Rapids, listening on WTKG, Clear Channel in Grand Rapids. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, this is just referring back to that earlier conversation about having citizens become more active. And I guess I didn't understand the actual specifics of how to do that. I mean, I've already been calling my congressmen, calling my representatives, my senators on a regular basis, writing letters, talking to people, signing petitions regularly, joining committees. I don't know what else the citizens can do.
Well, Jim, that what you're doing is fantastic. And do not underestimate the impact that you're having. We talked last week that the governor of Florida is now about to ban touchscreen balloting in Florida. If you think that that happened by accident, you're mistaken. Millions of people in this country said, we don't trust those machines. We want to make sure that the votes cast in Florida and in America are counted accurately. That is a direct result of grassroots activism. If you think it's an accident that right now in Washington there is a great deal of consternation and the need to address Iraq, if you think that that is not related to grassroots of America saying, we got to bring our troops home, you would be mistaken. The only other suggestion that I have for you, Jim, it sounds like you're doing a lot of right things, is all over America what people, in my view, should be doing is writing to their members of Congress, writing to their senators, and saying, look, sit down and talk to us on the issues. We're organizing a meeting. We want to talk to you about Iraq. We want to talk to you about the budget. We want to talk to you about global warming. We want to talk to you about media or the gap between the rich and the poor. And we are prepared to organize a meeting at your convenience. Let's do that. I think that would be a step forward.
Create your own town hall kind of thing?
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you find, and believe me, there are many districts where members of Congress are doing that already. They don't need the urging to do it. But there are many districts where they're not. And if they're not doing it, if they don't want to meet with the people, then the people should organize the meetings in a mutually convenient time frame. Members of Congress, you know, spend a whole lot of time in Washington. But do it at a time when the senator or the member of the House can be there and have that discussion.
Yeah.
That's what democracy is about.
And then the one thing I'd add to that is showing up at the political parties, even though you're an independent. I'm an independent. But still, show up at the Democratic Party meetings. Show up at the Republican Party meetings.
Absolutely.
If you're inclined.
Absolutely.
Get, you know, participate in the Green Party meetings or the Progressive Party meetings. Become part of the ongoing process. 45 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's the Tom Hartman Program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, actually, we fiendishly plot for things like clean elections and national health care. We'll be right back.
I felt so good, like anything was possible. Hit cruise control and rub my eyes. The last 3 days, the rain was unstoppable. It was always cold, no sunshine.
And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our number 1-866-440-8466. Chris in Seattle, Washington, you're live with Senator Sanders.
Hi, yes, Senator Sanders. I would like to ask in regards to Iraq, why can't we pass a law saying that companies cannot profit in wartime. And it seems to me that, you know, if you want, Halliburton wants to clean up Iraq, fine, but they don't get any money doing it. I'm imagining we'll be out of there pretty quick.
Well, the reconstruction of Iraq and the kinds of money that the contractors like Halliburton have made is an outrage. There have been huge ripoffs. And, Chris, what there is right now is there are committees that are taking a very hard look at that issue. And I personally think that those companies who have been ripping off the taxpayers and not providing the services that our soldiers need should be punished very, very strongly.
Amen. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and I've just got two quick questions. The first one I really need help with. I agree with both of you that corporations benefit from the this country, and they need to pay their fair share of taxes. How do we counter conservatives when they argue that corporations simply pass that expense on to the consumers? And the second question, it's my understanding that there's a 50% duty on ethanol from Brazil, no duty on oil from the Middle East. Are there plans to change that? Thanks.
Okay, the last point, Rich, on Brazil, what was that?
He's already dropped off. He said his understanding is there's a 50% tax, import tax duty on ethanol from Brazil, but there's no import duty on oil from the Middle East. How do we change that? And I'd like to take a shot at answering the first part.
Sure.
My answer to the first part is you go back to 1816. David Ricardo, one of the most famous economists in history, he wrote a book called On Profits, and he pointed out that the price of a commodity has nothing to do with the actual, has only small things to do with the actual cost of it, the cost of labor, the cost of taxes. The price of a commodity is what the market will bear. When Phil Knight figured out how to make Nikes cheaper, the price of Nikes didn't go down. Phil Knight got richer. And so if corporations are taxed, they're not going to pass that along if it's going to make their product unsaleable. They're going to reduce their profits, or they're going to figure out a different way to do business. So it's just when conservatives say, oh, you can't tax corporations because they'll just pass it along, they'll just raise the price of everything, it's just, you know, real economics, the real world of economics refutes that.
Well, and the second part of his point is that I think in Brazil they've made huge gains in moving off of fossil fuel for their transportation.
More than half of all their cars are now on renewable fuels, but their ethanol that they make there very cheaply with sugarcane, apparently we have a duty on the import of it.
Uh-huh.
So that was his point. I think that's probably to protect the corn companies here, but I don't know the details of it either.
Nor do I, but I do want to say that as a member of both the Environmental and Energy Committees, it just seems to me that we have incredible potential right now in this country with all of the new technology out there, whether it is biofuels, whether it is wind, whether it's solar, whether it is hydrogen, whether it's geothermal, we can make huge gains in breaking our dependency on fossil fuel and create a whole lot of good jobs in this country as we reverse global warming. And that's an issue that I think has huge potential for this country.
Indeed. Lynn in Los Alamos, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Lynn, welcome. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Bernie or Tom, it doesn't matter who answers this question, really. I am so confused about the fact that a lot of the questions that are going on right now about funding the troops in Iraq and about President Bush's powers as a wartime president, did we ever declare war?
Well, certainly we didn't officially declare war. The Congress, in fact, did give the president the authority to use military force against Iraq over 4 years ago, which is something that I voted against. So the president does have that authority. What people like Senator Kennedy and I and others have been saying, Senator Feingold have been saying, though, is that if you look at the reasons that the president gave for going to war against Iraq, which had to do with his belief, which was obviously wrong, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction poised to attack the United States, or that Iraq was somehow associated with Al-Qaeda. Those reasons no one thinks, including the president, are relevant today. We're not in Iraq now to rid that country of weapons of mass destruction. Nobody thinks that's the case. So a strong argument can be made, and I would make, that if the president wants to escalate the war, he needs a new authorization. Why are we in Iraq today? What is the reason that we're in Iraq? Let the president tell us and get that authority, if he can, from the Congress. Second of all, there is huge debates right now about a president who really thinks that he has the right to do anything he wants at any time, whether it is dealing with the Constitution of the United States and our civil liberties, whether it is with the war in Iraq, whether it is with a number of other areas. A president who does not understand our Constitution or the proper role of the Congress. And this is an issue that some of us are dealing with as well.
Okay. Doug in Seattle, a real quick question for Bernie. We're just about out of time.
Doug? Hi. I'll take my answer off the air. Senator, what's the most effective thing we can do if we live in a district in which our representatives really, truly represent us? I have no problem with my senators or...
Okay, hook up.
Thank you very much.
Hook up with friends and make friends in districts where their representatives do not represent the people.
Yeah, and can you call representatives in other districts?
You sure can.
Yeah, especially the heads of committees, right?
Because yes, you can.
They're more representative of all of us. So, Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segments. Senator Bernie Sanders, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always great having you here. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up next, Carol Tabor, college study on women in the military. This should be interesting. Plus, we'll be continuing taking your calls and talking about the news of the day right here on the Tom Hartman radio program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
So who's patriotic and who's not, and what's being taught in our colleges about all this? And who's willing to fight for this country and who's not? Carol Tabor with FamilySecurityMatters.org. She's the founder and president of FamilySecurityMatters.org on the line. Carol, you just commissioned a new national campus poll.
Correct.
And one of the things I thought that was most interesting in looking through the results of this poll was that when you asked if people were willing to join the military, take up arms to defend their country, women 43% yes, men 14% yes?
It was amazing that we found that surprise. You know, with most studies, there is a surprise, and this was ours. And actually, across the board, women scored much higher in terms of patriotic feelings about America. They had more respect for our various institutions like the Supreme Court and Congress and the presidency and so forth. And they also did say in much greater numbers that they would take up arms to defend America if she were attacked, much
what,
more so
what,
than
what? Now, you suggest that that might be the result of the influence of liberal college professors?
No, not at all, really. I think that what's happening now is that the military and the political realm are sort of the last frontiers for women. And they are now getting, I believe, as much attention as businesses did maybe 20 or 25 years ago for women. Women have advanced tremendously in business, but in politics, not as much. You know, if you look at the profile of the Congress, male, female.
Oh, you have a woman as Speaker of the House right now.
The case. But yes, but that's why I'm saying that because some breakthroughs, the old glass ceiling that we used to talk about with businesses, are being broken now in the arena of the military and in the arena of politics, so that this whole idea of women serving their country, whether through the military or through the political arena.
So you think it's a novelty factor?
Fascinating
for women?
To me. I think it's sort of a last frontier factor.
Interesting.
You know? And yes, there is novelty in that, of course, because it's untrod.
Yeah, indeed. Carol Tabor, the president and founder of SecurityMatters.org. In your study, you say if college faculties are successful in their efforts to convey a negative view of the U.S. to students on campus, the clear and present danger to the U.S. could result not from those who have already declared war on America and what she stands for, but from the apathy within.
Correct.
You believe that college professors are conveying a negative view of the United States to their students?
Well, we asked a lot of questions about that because we had been reading about you know, left-wing college professors. I can't remember. Ward Churchill was one and some others. And I began thinking, well, I wonder if this is, you know, sort of working. I mean, if children are paying attention to these people and these types of people and believing that everything that's bad in the world is bad because America was involved in it. And we did find a slight decrease in terms of positive feelings about America as kids go through college, because this was a national study. It was 1,000 college young men and women. It was taken across the nation, every region of the country, every type of college, from city colleges up through the Ivy League, and every grade level. And so we saw a slight diminution of positive feelings about America. It wasn't a lot, though, I must admit. But one thing that bothered me a lot, and this is as a person who has spent an awful lot of money on college tuition, is the topics that are discussed in class. When we asked what are the topics that are most discussed in class, the number one topic was the Bush administration at 73%, but yet one of the biggest threats that faces us now as a nation and actually as Western civilization is nuclear proliferation and the spread of radical Islam, and they came in at only 39%, so, you know, almost half.
Could it be, Carol Tabor, that many people in college, particularly as they begin to learn the history of the United States, they actually read the Constitution, they discover, apparently Alberto Gonzalez doesn't know this, he said that there is no right of habeas corpus in the Constitution, but as they learn, for example, the history of the Magna Carta and the British habeas corpus laws and the right of habeas corpus in the United States, and then they see an administration like the Bush administration stripping us of habeas corpus, tearing away the foundations of America, taking away our Fourth Amendment rights of privacy, taking away our Fifth Amendment rights to not be held without due process of law, taking away our Sixth and Seventh and Eighth Amendment rights to a trial by jury, that they look at that and they say, hey, maybe the terrorists have already won. Maybe the Bush administration is worse than the threat of international terrorism.
Well, this wasn't reflected in the study. I mean, when we asked, did you discuss these following topics, it was merely the Bush administration. It wasn't, these various things that you just outlined.
But those are all coming from the Bush administration.
Well,
none of those, there hasn't been an administration that went after civil liberties like this, arguably since Franklin Roosevelt put Japanese in concentration camps, or Woodrow Wilson, two Democrats, by the way, in World War I, passed the Alien, a second version of the Alien Sedition Acts, or then, John Adams back in 1798.
And also Abraham Lincoln, during the Civil War.
Yeah, although the Constitution does say that you can suspend habeas corpus during times of insurrection and rebellion. It's specifically in the Constitution. So, Lincoln arguably had some basis for it.
Well, I do, we're at war as well.
But it's not an insurrection or a rebellion.
Well, war has been declared against this country. It was declared against us, back in the 90s.
But it's not an insurrection or a rebellion. In 1812, when we were invaded, we were actually, the Canadians and the British actually took our soil, took the White House, and set it on fire. James Madison, the president at the time, did not stand up and say, oh, this is terrible. We've been invaded. We've been attacked from without. We need to do away with the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, Seventh, Eighth, and Eighth Amendments of the Constitution. We need to do away with habeas corpus. And this is unprecedented what Bush is doing.
Well, I my problem is not so much that the professors are talking about that subject. My problem is that they're not talking about nuclear proliferation and the spread of radical Islam and its threat to Western democracies. That really worries me, because it makes me think, how are these young, in fact, our next generation of leaders, how are they going to be prepared to come into the real world if they haven't been deeply schooled in the ideology that faces us?
You don't think that the average college student realizes that we were hit by religious fanatics on 9/11, and that we were hit by religious fanatics in Oklahoma City? You had Tim McVeigh, who was citing the Christian Bible, who was citing the New Testament as the basis for why he blew up the Oklahoma building. We've had two major acts of terrorism by religious fundamentalists in the United States.
What I fear, though, is to mix religion and politics, sort of the way you're doing now, Tom, and I don't mean to offend you, but But I think it needs to be made perfectly clear that the religion of Islam is a very different thing from the political movement of Islamism. It's a very, very different thing.
Just like the religion of Christianity, which I proudly proclaim myself as a member of, is a different thing from the Christianists in this country who want to take over the government and have do away with the Constitution, replace it with the Bible. And there's a large movement in this country to do that, as you know.
Yes, I'm not debating that either, you know, but that.
So shouldn't we be teaching about the danger of the Tim McVeighs? I mean, there's almost a million of them in the United States.
But that movement that you just outlined, you know, they're not into beheading most of the people who live in this country.
Tell that to the families whose babies were blown up in the Oklahoma school building.
I couldn't agree with you more. That's not the global threat that faces us. This movement of radical Islam is in virtually every country in the world, and it threatens people throughout the world. Certainly, all of
isn't our best defense against that, Carol Tabor, to be looking to be that beacon of light, to be that shining city on the hill that Ronald Reagan talked about, to go back to our core values and hold them up rather than strip them from us the way the Bush administration is doing?
Well, I guess I don't agree with you thoroughly that the Bush administration is stripping us of it. I do believe that there has been a move to the right, and in the country now we have, this is the beautiful thing about a free market, you know, we can, the pendulum swings, and so many people thought that we moved too far to the right and we're swinging back to the left now, you know, so I fully believe in the free market that we have and how it constantly adjusts itself as it is doing right now. You know, I have no political stake in this. What I care about is the fact that a political movement has declared war on America. And
the liberals.
I worry that we're not educating our next generation of leaders about it well enough.
Okay. Carol Tabor, she's the founder and president of FamilySecurityMatters.org. The website, of course, FamilySecurityMatters.org. Carol, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good conversation. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody is free, and that's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, listening for our local sponsors, your affiliates. That's what's keeping this show on your local radio station. Let them know you're listening. And our national sponsors as well, like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One Natural Blends, 1-866-380-MEOW. So let's see. The cons are very concerned that the liberals in college may cause, what was the exact phrasing from this study? If college faculties are successful in their efforts to convey a negative view of the U.S. to the students on campus, the clear and present danger to the U.S. could result not from those who have already declared war on America and what she stands for, but from the apathy within. Now, it's interesting. The majority of CEOs of major corporations, who are almost always college educated, are mostly Republicans. The majority of the officer corps in our military service who are required to be college educated, about two-thirds, identify with the GOP. So does that mean, you know, what does that mean? I mean, how do you, does that mean we should stop educating these folks? Or they missed something? Or actually, what I would suggest to you is if people become more liberal as a result of going to college, it's because they understand how the world works better. They start getting it. They start figuring out, you know, what is really going on, and what this country, hopefully, what this country really was founded on, our core founding principles, rather than the jingoism that you hear from the O'Reillys and whatnot on faux news. Anyhow, 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, Pamela in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Pamela.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Hi.
Can you hear me all right?
I can, just fine, thank you.
Oh, okay. Well, I want to thank you for having that guest on. By the way, good bumper music, one of my favorite songs.
Yeah, me too.
But it's remarkable, and I think you did an admirable job of rebutting her, but it's remarkable in the way that not only was the interest, the study was interesting, but also the way that she was so worried about three specific things, and that was that we were teaching, talking about the administration, or, you know, Bush administration in schools, that the spread of Islamic radical fundamentalism and the and nuclear proliferation, and yet she refused to see any connection between any of those three things and the Bush administration.
Right. Yeah, and that was my point. I mean, people around the world are looking at what's going on in the United States right now and saying, well, I guess they don't take those egalitarian ideals really seriously. I mean, you've got the Bush administration saying that they have the right to kidnap people anywhere in the world and make them just vanish and torture them and, you know, and keep them in prison forever and then hold a kangaroo court trial and execute them.
And she sees no danger to our civil liberties going on, and therefore why should we be talking about the Bush administration instead of these other things that he apparently has nothing to do with?
Right, yeah. And I just, you know, have to respectfully disagree. Thank you, Pamela. Karen in Federal Way. Hey, Karen.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to say, you know, if she's really concerned about Islamists and the spread of terrorism, it's like, I'm crippled. I just have a car. I walk, and I take public transit because I, by golly, am not going to buy Saudi oil and fund the schools of terrorism that they pour their money in throughout the globe.
Yeah. I mean, they still have textbooks that highly offensive to Christians and Jews.
Absolutely. And after the Saudi Arabians, and what about Pakistan?
Yeah. If you want to stop Islamic terrorists looking at the United States, then let's stop our presence in their part of the world. You want to stop our presence in their part of the world? Stop being dependent on foreign oil. Let's go back to what Jimmy Carter was talking about. Let's make America independent of foreign oil, period. Real simple. Karen, you said it very well. Thank you very much. Lee in Duval, Washington. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm fine. What's on your mind?
Hey, reading the newspaper this morning, I'm reading about this exodus from New Orleans.
Yes, sir.
People are fed up with the corruption and the embezzlement and the corruption. I'm really starting to see a parallel. It kind of hit me. I see this parallel with what's going on in Iraq. We go in there and we invade. We're supposed to be bringing democracy, but what we end up doing is all these direct award contracts to all Bush's buddies and all the people who supported him and this war.
Well, that's the kind of democracy that Bush wants to bring, is essentially a libertarian, objectivist, hyper-conservative version of a bizarre free market that they think is, he calls it freedom. He doesn't call it democracy because that sounds too much like the Democratic Party.
And it shows that it's not just the radical Muslims that are going to act this way. Anybody, anywhere, you invade their country or you do this kind of stuff in their cities and you're going to have this kind of problem.
Yeah, the British had that problem with us, for example. I mean, yes.
Another thing I think is really important that nobody's talking about is for years now, for the last few years, Russia and China have been stating their dissatisfaction with Americans' aggression, and I think these two countries are building up against this, and I think Russia's supplying Iran missiles, and I think we're really going to get ourselves into way over our head here.
Yeah, I agree with you, Lee. I think we may already have, to a certain extent. Putin just came out and said he's going to take unspecified but serious rebuttals, or rejoinders, consequences for our placing missiles in Poland. 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. 34 minutes past the hour. Hey, they're starting to push back. They're starting to push back seriously. The Bush administration, they've just been, you know, going along. I mean, anybody gets in their way, they get punished, right? Joe Wilson speaks up, out his wife. So what? So it doesn't matter if it's going to bring down an entire CIA operation, Brewster Jennings with offices all over the world. People are going to get murdered and killed as a result of it. Just out the whole thing. Turns out, apparently, this thing started with Dick Cheney.
And if somebody starts looking into something like this, Duke Cunningham, he's making a fortune. Federal prosecutor goes after Duke Cunningham, throws his butt in jail. What do? You fire the federal prosecutor. In fact, seven U.S. attorneys, people who are looking into corruption and crimes of the Bush administration, among others, have been forced to resign. Carol Lamb, for example, she's the one who investigated the corruption of Duke Cunningham. And in their place, Alberto Gonzalez putting in, quote, partisan administration ally. This is, you know, from a report, and actually a variety of reports. This one from realcities.org. Earlier this week, this is from thinkprogress.org. Earlier this week, Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty admitted that the U.S. Attorney in Arkansas, Bud Cummings, was pushed out to make way for a 37-year-old protege of Karl Rove. The Justice Department originally tried to say, the guy left on his own. No, sorry. Karl Rove's young man wanted a job, and Karl Rove got him the job, even though it meant firing a U.S. attorney. The other six, they said, well, we fired them all for performance-related issues. Well, two of them now have spoken out. The former U.S. attorney in Nevada, Daniel Bogden, he said, I was told that I serve as a presidential appointee. Any further explanation than that? No, I was not given any explanation or reason for the request to step down. We've done more gun cases, drug cases, gang cases, child exploitation cases, identity theft cases than any office has done in any five-year period of time. Well, of course, that's why you were asked to step down, Mr. Bogdan. Come on, get with the program. Government isn't supposed to be competent. The Bush administration wants government to be incompetent so they can point at things like New Orleans. Say, see, FEMA didn't work. Get rid of the government. Bring in Blackwater. Bring in Halliburton. John McKay, former U.S. attorney in Washington, said he was called December 7th by Michael A. Battle, head of the Executive Office of U.S. Attorneys, who only months before had sent him a congratulatory letter. He said when I was and told him that, you know, he was going to be forced to resign at the end of January. He said when I was composed enough to ask him why, he told me he couldn't answer any of my questions. He said nothing about performance issues or management or anything else. So now the Senate Judiciary Committee, Pat Leahy's committee, they're looking into this. I think it's time to... These guys are crooks. We should be using the RICO Act, the Organized Crime and Racketeering Act. We should be using the RICO Act against the Republican Party right now because they're running that thing like a criminal syndicate. Harp in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Hey, Harp.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I'm calling because of the woman who said that she was using every kind of alternative transportation she could think of because she doesn't want to support soy oil, and I totally agree with that, and I think people should stop using their cars if they can. But for those who can't, I want to recommend that people use Citgo, buy their oil from Venezuela, where that money will actually be put into lower and middle class, helping the lower and middle class rather than the rich in Venezuela.
Good point, yeah. Jeff Cohen, I think it was, who published the original piece on Common Dreams saying, let's have a boycott instead of a boycott and move all your purchases of oil and petroleum products, gasoline and whatnot, to Citgo away from the other vendors. Thanks, Harp, for the heads up, for the reminder on that. Appreciate it. Brad in Austin, Texas. Hey, Brad, what's on your mind today?
Hello. A couple things. I've joined the parade. Thank you for...
Good on you.
Attention to that.
Good on you, Brad.
And back to school now, thanks to you. I have to, somebody else called and said every time they hear you, they got to get a piece of paper and pencil right away, and I'm doing that, making better informed decisions, like trading in my Navigator and getting a hybrid. I'm getting my feet on the ground. I'm going to host a MoveOn.org movie event next week, and tomorrow I'm going against Texas Utilities, who wants to fire up eight more, I believe, coal plants Texas. But the reason why I was calling is...
Good on you for your activism, Brad.
Well, thank you. And there's just I'm wanting to let you know that there's a lot of us out here, and it's going on, and
and I'm excited. You're a breath of fresh air and actually saved me from moving to Cozumel and, you know,
well, thank
moving
you.
The country. So.
You know, I'm hearing this, not about me, but what I'm hearing all over the country is that people are waking up. They are getting active. They are, you know, taking a cue from you know, what was the movie? Network. You know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And they're starting to participate. And I think it's just a marvelous thing, what you're doing. But that's not what you called about, right?
Well, I'm living the American dream, too. I mean, I'm an independent businessman and have been real successful. And I don't have time to go tell these criminals to get out of our government and give it back to us, but it has to be done.
Mm.
And that's been the biggest challenge for me is to you know, realize that the only way this is going to work, I've emailed, I've made phone calls, I've voted, I've petitioned, and you've said we got to have the people's feet on the ground and like you said, make the parade. So it's hard because I'm working and I don't have time, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Great.
So the reason why I called was you talked about framing and NLP and I'm still learning about all that, but it's amazing to me how well the Republican Party has framed the conversation over and over and over again. And what concerns me is that it seems to me like the Democrats just follow right after and use the same languaging and support the framing that they use. For instance, let's see here. I had a bunch of them. I'm a little nervous talking to you, so bear with me.
It's okay.
Well, actually, I'll just go to the issue that stood out for me. You know, there's a framing of Democrats equal taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And the other day, John Edwards was on TV, and he's great. I love him. He's brilliant. And he talked about universal health. He said, well, how are you going to pay for that? Are you going to raise taxes? And he said, yes. And I thought, why isn't it being raised that there just in pork barrel projects for the year 2006, there was $29 billion wasted in that.
Right.
Just in the tax cuts to the wealthiest was $56 billion, the 1%.
Right.
The budget, Bush's budget for Iraq is $145 billion more dollars just for the next year.
You know what, Brad, you make a good point. And however, what Edwards did, which I thought was, you know, actually a very brave thing to say, yes, we're going to have to raise taxes, was he was going in right into the jaws of that you know, read my lips and the whole anti-tax hysteria. And the fact of the matter is that when you poll Americans and you ask them broadly, and I haven't seen any good national polls on this, but I've seen a lot of statewide polls, state-by-state polls, and I know in particular here in the area where I live in the Pacific Northwest, you ask people, are you willing to pay more in taxes if you know that that means that you're going to have better schools and better public services? People will always say yes. They will always say yes. So I think that there's nothing wrong with saying, you know, yes, we're going to have a national health care system, and yes, we're going to fund it by increasing taxes slightly, although, you know, your employer's not going to have to pay for it anymore, so maybe you'll get a raise.
Well, I don't have a problem raising paying taxes, and I understand. I mean, thanks to you, I understand the concept of the commons, and there's things that we share as a community that we pay for as a community, and I have no problem with that. But it seems to me like there's so much waste with our tax dollars now already. I mean, it's incredible, beyond comprehension for me, that just cutting, you know, why isn't that brought up at all? Just if we just
well, it is
waste.
You're right. It is, and it is, and it's really, you know, $36 billion is a drop in the bucket when you're looking at a $1 trillion budget. It really is. And the biggest thing is, I mean, you know, there's $1 trillion missing from the Pentagon budget. I mean, you know, waste. I mean, that's the waste and fraud in the Pentagon budget is so huge. It could keep a full-time investigator going continuously. But yeah, you know, Edwards probably should have brought that up too, even, and maybe he did, and it just didn't make it into the soundbite, you know, because the media just jumped all over the taxes thing. Brad, I got to move along. Thanks for the call, though. I appreciate
it.
Thank you for listening and you know, letting your Air American station there in Austin know that you're looking forward to our show being on, replacing Al Franken. And here's Howard Beale.
You've got to say, I'm a human being. My life has value.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
And that's what we have to do, and that's what people are doing. They're standing up and speaking out. They're calling their members of Congress. They're writing letters to the editor of their newspapers. They're showing up at the meetings. They're standing out on the street corners all over the United States, in virtually every city in this country, certainly in every major city, in a lot of medium and small-sized towns across the United States. Every Friday afternoon, every Saturday, sometimes every single day of the week, there are people standing out there with signs, the people, you know, and protesting, saying, hey, we are speaking out. Pay attention to a national movement. 45 minutes past the hour.
As a young man, I found politics in Bush's army door. And I got real good at dirty tricks. My name, sir, is Karl Rove. Oh, Dick Cheney, don't you cry for me, 'cause when your administration is gone, the right will kiss my knee.
Yes, the old Karl Rove song. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Lynn in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Well, your live chat is really very lively. I got in and out. It's like swimming with the sharks. They really work fast.
It really does move along.
Yes. I'm calling about Bernie Sanders' remark about what's going on in Florida.
Uh-huh.
In fact, in the 2004 presidential elections, I did a comparative analysis of the counties that used the ballot scanners.
Oh, is this Lynn Landis?
Yes, yes.
Hey, Lynn.
Lenny from Philly.
Yeah, Lynn Landis, what's the best website for you now? Is it EcoTalk? Or is it...
Well, actually, thelandisreport.com.
With a the on it?
Yes, the. Yeah, the Landis, L-A-N-D-E-S.
ES
Report.com. And actually on that, on the page with voting and politics, I just did put what I'm going to tell you right now about that comparative analysis I did. The large counties had the paperless touchscreens in Florida, but all the other counties, dozens and dozens of them, had the optical scans. And you would be shocked when you look at the results. And this is what happened, that in those counties, Bush was getting a crossover vote from Democrats and all other parties that constituted routinely 200, 300, 400, and in one case, 600% of Republican registration.
This is in the counties that were
that
using touchscreen machines?
No.
That were
in
using
the counties
scan
that used
machines.
The ballot scanners.
So you're suggesting that the ballot scanners that Governor Crist is moving to now in Florida are just as corruptible, and in fact the evidence is that they were more seriously corrupted than the touchscreen machines.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, he's getting rid of the touchscreen machines, but he's replacing them with ESNS AutoMark. That's AUTOMARK. And these are ballot markers. And so it's still a computer. The ballots can still be mismarked. They can be misscanned. And even the paper that is being used can be a source of fraud. They can hide things on that paper and make those computers or program the computers to miscount those votes. And the other thing about Florida is they have a state law that in the event of a recount, it's the electronic tally that will prevail over any hand count.
Hey, hey.
And unfortunately, that's also...
This all goes back to Tom Feeney, right?
Well, it's also the same case with Rush Holt's bill that he's just introduced. Yeah. is a disaster.
I am very ambivalent about it. It's why I had somebody in the chat room say, you know, why aren't you talking about Rush Holt's bill? And it's because I just don't think we should have any private corporations in this business at all, period. I think that, you know, if we're going to use machines, that they need to be, you know, private corporations can make them, but they need to be open source software. They need to be owned by the governments, period. And frankly, I would rather we didn't do that. I'd rather we just went back to paper and civil servants and take a day or two to count the vote if that's what it takes. And, I mean, they do it in Canada. They do it in every country in Europe. They do it in Japan. They do it all over the world. It works just fine. Thank you very much.
Well, what I would request of Bernie also is that other hearings be held, because Senator Feinstein's hearing on e-voting the other morning, her office posted that on Saturday. The hearing was on Wednesday. None of us were
were notified, you know, it was, it just looked like a complete setup because the people, half the people invited are the same people who've been promoting paperless touchscreen machines. So it really looked sort of intentional to keep many of us who've brought this issue to the nation's attention out of the public eye.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Ouch. Yeah. Well, we need to just say, you know, no more machines, period.
Exactly.
Let's just get rid of them. You know, let's take some time and work out the technology if we're going to have. I mean, yes, we had machines before, you know, the pull lever machines or whatever they were called, the mechanical machines. But you could at least lift up the back and look at the little wheels and dials and see how they worked. And even then, there was some concern about fraud.
Well, you know, what I'm suggesting is we have one standard for voting, the same standard for elected officials we have for ourselves. Let's just have total transparency. Let's get rid of all the secrecy. Let's make sure our votes are counted.
Yeah, and I'd love to see what we have here in Oregon done nationally, which is vote by mail. It seems to be
whoa, no.
You're opposed to that.
No, you're giving these election officials, what happened in Ohio just recently, two election officials got convicted of cherry-picking ballots in a hand count, in a recount. What do you think they're doing in the original count? The people in Oregon are going to be a lot less satisfied when they find it, you know, when what happens to them happened to the voters in Nebraska, where all of a sudden they got Chuck Hagel, who owned the voting machine company.
Yeah.
They may be satisfied with this system right now because they have perhaps progressive representatives, but all of a sudden things can change on a dime when the process is in the hands of the election officials.
Yeah, it is corruptible. Well, that's we talked with George. What's his name? The member of parliament, and in his district there was a big scandal. People were buying up ballots and mailing them in. But you know, it's yeah.
Well, okay. Listen. By the good way, point. I want to say congrats on getting Al Franken's spot. I think that's terrific. You're doing a wonderful job.
It's a lot more work. It's going to be. Thanks a lot, Lynn. I'm looking forward to it.
You're very welcome.
I appreciate the call. Indeed. 1-866-440-8466. We'll be continuing with your calls in just a minute. Dan Schulman with MotherJones.com, Mother Jones, an investigative fellow at Mother Jones, in fact, is going to be with us at the top of the next hour. And we're going to be talking about highway privatization, how the cons, another scheme that the cons have figured out to get our commons, our property, and then charge us money for it. And, you know, basically screw America some more. And, in fact, a lot of these companies aren't even American companies that are doing it. Plus, we'll be taking your calls and more news of the day right after this. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the USA.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Dan Schulman on the line with Mother Jones, MotherJones.com on the web, Mother Jones the magazine. He's in a senior investigative fellow at Mother Jones. Hey, Dan.
How are you, Tom? Nice to talk to you again.
I am just great. Great to have you on the program again with us. You have done some really serious investigative reporting here on an issue that I think all of us should be not just concerned about, we should be just flaming outraged about, and that is this ongoing selling off of the most critical core part of our commons, the part that Dwight Eisenhower, for example, the Republican president, identified as being so essential to the United States, our highway system.
Right.
Tell us what the state of this is right now.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it looks like you're going to start seeing this a lot more. And the reason why I say this is because two of the biggest proponents of this within the administration are now in very high positions. You've got Mary Peters, who's the Secretary of the Department of Transportation, Now, she moderated a discussion on privatization of the roads in 2005 that was called Let's Make a Deal. I mean, and where she talks about essentially unleashing the power of the free market here. So she's totally behind this. Now the person that was just nominated to be the general counsel of the Department of Transportation is Macquarie, a lobbyist for one of the firms that's buying up the roads, the Australian firm Macquarie.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's at the Department of Transportation. He's a former general counsel to the Federal Highway Administration too, and he as well is behind this. But now, I mean, if you read the paper, you see that you know, New Jersey is considering privatizing it's the New Jersey Turnpike. There's talk about doing this in New York and Pennsylvania, you know, really all over the place.
Yeah. So how much, I mean, what any sense of percentage or dollars or, you know, the number of, give us a, I mean, there's some, just a whole bunch of startling pieces of information here in this article I'm looking at, you know, the hundreds of billions of dollars, this, give us a summary.
Well, basically, I mean, this whole trend kicked off in May 2005 with the privatization of the Chicago Skyway, which went to this one of these firms, Macquarie, who partnered with an Australian, a Spanish construction firm called Cintra. Mm-hmm. They're the major players in this right now. And basically, they paid $1.8 billion for a 99-year lease on this road. Now, a year later, they bought a connecting segment of road, the Indiana Toll Road. They leased it for 75 years, $3.8 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the money here is really staggering. But people say that a stretch of road like the New Jersey Turnpike or the Pennsylvania Turnpike, you know, could go for $20 billion. But these companies are more than willing to pay for this because this is a really good investment for them. These are stable investments.
This is like playing Monopoly and getting the, you know, the Marvin Gardens or getting the utilities or whatever. You know, so once you've got it, you've got it forever, and people just have to pay.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, in you know, basically under the terms of these deals, these companies can raise the tolls on the roads annually.
Now this raises one of the big issues, Dan Shulman with MotherJones.com, Mother Jones Magazine, that it seems to me that this is really what's going on. That there's two things. Number one, that states are being starved by movements within the states, conservative movements within the states, to cut back funding. In some cases, even passing ballot initiatives and getting legislation passed to basically cripple the ability of states to support their own infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're looking for revenue sources, and so selling off their highways is a short-term fix, number one. Plus, they're being starved by a lack of federal funds coming to them. And perhaps most importantly, number two, because of the political paranoia, the political fear of raising the tolls on the roads, the states know that they could run these things, they could run these roads not just at break even, which is, you know, ideally how the commons should be run. They could run them as a profit and use that extra money to pay for example, a healthcare program for the state. But they're afraid to raise the toll because they don't want to take the political heat for it. Whereas if they sell it to a private corporation, that private corporation raises the toll, the politicians get to shrug and say, hey, it's not us, it's this company in Australia, go talk to them.
Yeah, that's precisely right. They want, I think that Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, who was really the chief architect of the deal there, basically said as much. I mean, he said he didn't believe that the state had the political will to just raise the tolls to a rational level. I mean, the tolls there were hadn't been raised for 20 years.
Yeah.
And it's the same way with the gas tax, which funds the federal highway system and the state highway systems. No one wants to raise those taxes because they're afraid they're going to get voted out of office for doing so. But the alternative is really losing control of the federal highway system piece by piece. And, you know, you're seeing it happen right now. And believe me, from what I can tell, these companies really have designs on big segments of the interstate highway system. I mean, we're talking about the Eastern Corridor.
Right. This is the Enronization of our vital assets. I mean, Enron did this with power. You know, look at what they did with California when they wanted to get rid of Gray Davis. Ken Lay flies out there. He has a secret meeting with Arnold Schwarzenegger. A few weeks later, suddenly California starts going brown. The price of energy goes through the roof. Enron is shutting down reactors and power plants to drive the price up. You know, this whole criminal conspiracy that frankly never really got exposed. I mean, it got exposed, never got prosecuted. It should, but you know, it won't because Schwarzenegger was right in the middle of it. In my opinion, I mean, it's just looking at it from the outside, but he's never, in my opinion, answered the question of, you know, why was he at that meeting? What was discussed? But you know, it's documented apparently that he was there. But they took control of the power. I mean, we're here in Portland. We've still got Enron. Well, actually, they just sold it off to PGE here. But it's it's another private corporation. So the vital assets, they're going after our water supply.
Right.
And now they're going after our highways. They're going after sanitation systems.
Oh, yeah, they're going after a lot of things. I mean, they're going to go after ports. They're going to go after airports.
They already have a lot of our ports. I mean, this whole thing about the Dubai ports deal wasn't, you know, let's privatize them. It was about one private corporation selling them to another private corporation. They're already owned by a British company.
Exactly. The real insidious thing here, though, is that, not only is the administration fully on board with this and pushing this trend, but you've got investment banks, namely Goldman Sachs, who's out there, lobbying heavily for this stuff, going around the country.
Gee, Goldman Sachs, and the former president of Goldman Sachs is who right now?
The Treasury Secretary.
Yes, Mr. Snow.
But he's also, you know, a former Goldman CEO is John Corzine in New Jersey, who's pushing this stuff. And I think the citizens there are actually starting to say, you know, wait a minute, why do you want to do this again? No, I mean, Goldman Sachs had a really unusual role in all of this. They have been out there, number one, spurring the market. They're going to every state in the country saying, you know, you guys should consider privatization.
Right.
And then they're getting in on these advisory deals where they're advising the states on the deals. And then they're raising an infrastructure fund, which is basically so they can be a principal investor in these deals. So they're all over the map, and they're
right.
Really,
plus they take a fee at every stage along the way, I would guess, or a percentage of the action.
Yeah, they get a 0.5% off these deals when they advise, and they get, like, so in Indiana they got $20 million. But that's really a drop in the bucket compared to, you know, the investments they want to make. They're raising a $3 billion infrastructure fund.
So we could end up, if this trend continues, Dan Shulman, we could end up with America literally being owned from our school systems, and because they've been trying to privatize them for a long time. The whole voucher thing is the beginning of that. To our roads, to our water supply, to our electric supply, with all of the critical infrastructure of this nation being owned by private corporations, and we, the people, end up owning nothing.
Absolutely. And these firms, the real problem here is that these firms are not accountable to the public in any shape or form. Their allegiance is solely to their shareholders. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with these businesses being out there trying to make money. That's not what I'm saying. It's just, but I think you have to ask.
But not with our commons.
Yeah, it's just a
not with our commons.
It just doesn't really, it just doesn't sit too well with a lot of people around the country.
I track this back to the Reagan administration when they did the war on teaching civics in our high schools, and they stopped teaching kids about the commons. We have, you know, 25 years, 26 years now, people who haven't been taught civics, and people just don't even understand what the commons are.
Right.
And it's just, it's a tragedy. Dan Shulman, you can read all about it over at Mother Jones, motherjones.com. The Highwayman is the title of the article. Why you could soon be paying Wall Street investors, Australian bankers, and Spanish builders for the privilege of driving on Americans' roads. Dan, great work. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom. Take care.
You too. 16 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. After the break, at the bottom of the hour, we're going to be doing our online or on-the-air book, writing our book, Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Communication. And we're going to be talking about trances. training trances, learning trances, trances in politics. I think you'll find it real interesting for that segment. But first, let's take a few phone calls here. Brian in Laguna Beach, California. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. And by the way, I don't know if you know this, but your show is actually a great cure for intellectual pig-headedness, because I woke up this morning feeling kind of full of myself, you know, thinking I was just so smart. And I got to tell you, 2 to 3 minutes of the Tom Hartman show, it just cleared that right up.
Oh, well, thank you, Brian.
Yeah, but anyway, the reason I was calling is I think there's a way we can frame the discussion of this war so that we can roll back these despicable tax cuts, because you know, we're going to need a two-thirds vote in Congress to get past Bush, and that's something we can get with a strong enough public outcry. So let me know if you think this would work.
Actually, it needs to be two-thirds in the Senate to break a filibuster. I think it's three-quarters in the House to be veto-proof.
Oh, is it? I thought it was two.
Yeah, I may be wrong.
Fortunately, that's a whole bunch anyway. Something that we can influence directly with public opinion, unlike some of this, you know, military stuff.
Yeah.
We just got to kind of cross our fingers and hope. But I think the frame needs to be Bush is taxing our children. And tax dollars are paying for this war, but Bush is saying this tax bill should be paid entirely by our children. We're asking our kids to fight this war for us. Is it really fair to ask them to pay for it for us, too?
And not just them, but their children as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we're giving a debt not just to the 20- and 30-year-olds who are fighting, but to the children that they're coming home and having who are going to be paying the bills, you know, 30, 40 years from now. These debts don't.
Yeah.
You know, most of it is financed by the sale of 20-year treasuries, but the government does roll them over continuously. This debt is going to be with us for a long time.
But people really feel, like, when you talk about their children, because I'm a father of a 2-year-old, and I really realize how much it hits you. You know, how much people have a very emotional reaction to that, because we can't use $500 billion. It's just too big of a number. People don't feel that.
Yeah.
It needs to be like if 10 cents on every dollar is going to pay interest on this $500 billion loan, then we need to frame that in terms of 1 out of every 10 of our children, you know, won't be able to qualify for, you know, federal student loans or won't be able to. And technically that's not exactly true, but I just think that we have to get off the
No, I mean, it's just, I think we can even boil it down to just a very simple thing, and that is that all of the money that Bush is spending on the war right now is money that he's borrowing from our children.
Yeah.
And just say it like
just
that.
Just leave it at that.
And then people go, whoa, you know, at that point.
And if we roll back the tax cuts, it'll be supposed to pay for some of it now.
That's right.
It's not going to alleviate the debt from our kids, but at least, you know, split the bill. Let's do our fair share. We started this war. Our generation did. Let's do the right thing. Let's take responsibility and pay for at least some of it.
Yes. Hey, well said, Brian. Thank you very much for the call. Jim in San Mateo, California. Hey, Jim.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I was really alarmed just hearing about the privatization of highways and all the rest of it. Tom, can you explain to me what in our laws allow both federal and state and local, allow legislators to just give away or sell or whatever public property?
Well, this is the problem. There are not good, clear definitions in either the Constitution or at law in general about where the commons begins and ends. There was, you know, one unique area where the commons was identified early on was in the 1920s with the original Radio Act that ultimately created the FCC, when they said, okay, we've got these airwave things here and we've figured out that you can send signals over them. I guess we're all going to collectively own them. We're going to call that the commons, and we're going to regulate them, and we're going to rent them out to commercial stations. That's probably, arguably, the only example. I mean, you could go back to, you know, maybe you could go back to Ben Franklin starting the public library system, Ben Franklin starting our public fire department system. I suppose you could argue that the Army and the Navy and the Marines and the police have always been considered part of the commons. Although they're privatizing those things now. I mean, you know, look at, we have almost as many private contractors in Iraq as we have soldiers. The second largest army in Iraq is American mercenaries. So the problem is there are not clear, bright lines.
Yeah. And then, you know, while you're talking about the airwaves, MoveOn.org had a thing on my email where the defunding of NPR and PBS station and such as that, and doing a movement on that, which I responded to. But what was it that Reagan did in his administration? It was the fair, you know, where...
In 86, he did away with the Fairness Doctrine in 86. And it was a collection of laws, FCC rules, basically, some of which had to do with content on the radio. Like, you know, if you have Party A on, you also have the Party B on, which I frankly have a problem with. But more than that, there was this a piece of the Fairness Doctrine which said that radio and television stations, in order to have their licenses, must serve the public good. And that's one of the reasons why everybody had news, and they actually lost money on their news operations because they had to do them in a way that demonstrably served the public good. And Reagan, to a large part, did away with that, and then Clinton put the absolute nail in the coffin and finished the job off in 1996 with the Telecommunications Act. So, okay. Jim, thanks okay. a lot
thanks
for the call. Yep, I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. We're gonna come back and talk about trances and politics. After the break, share some commercials with you, and then we'll continue to take a few more of your calls as we wrap up the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program on this beautiful Friday afternoon, 27 minutes past the hour.
Thunder on the mountain and as far as the moon, the ruckus in the alley and the thunder will be as you. Today's the day you're gonna grab my trombone and blow. Well, it's hot stuff here and it's everywhere I go.
And welcome back. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change in America. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Trances. This is for our book, Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. Trances. Most people think that a trance is where a person is no longer here. They're no longer paying attention. Somebody is so hypnotized, for example, they're so in a trance that you can do dental work on them without anesthesia, or put their arm in cold water and they don't know it, or make them have, feel like their leg is cold or hot or whatever. And the common belief is that the reason that all those things can happen in a trance is because there is a lack of attention. It is in fact the opposite. A trance is the result of a surplus of attention, not a deficit. You've heard me before talk about how most of us can attend to 7 plus or minus 2 things and no more. For example, until I say it, you probably didn't notice the position that your body is in right now, but now you're noticing it. You probably didn't notice whether or not your shoes were tight, but now you're noticing it. What I'm doing is I'm throwing your attention around in different directions, right? You didn't notice, you know, the weight of your butt on the chair or whatever posture you may be in, but now you're noticing it. So the way to induce a trance is to amp up attention in a very, very narrow spectrum of area. So the way stage hypnotists induce trance, for example, is by causing a person to focus just on their voice, or on a particular point, or on a particular sensation. They'll say, you know, put your fingers together, and then I'm very wary of doing that stuff on the air because I don't want anybody driving down the street to be in a trance. But that's the technique that's used, just in summary, is that the way to induce a trance is to cause a person to focus more and more and more and more intensely. And the more, and you know, you hear that some people are very easily hypnotized, some people it's more difficult. Those people who are more easily hypnotized are those people who more easily focus their attention, who can highly focus. They're the most hypnotizable. But everybody goes into trances all the time. We all do. Sometimes it's called daydreaming, where we're so focused on something. Sometimes it's reading a book and you're not noticing the clock ticking in the room. That's a reading trance. Sometimes it's listening to a talk show or attending to the media, or listening to a teacher. That's a training trance. In fact, we talk in the industry, in the business, as it were, they talk about training trances, learning trances, and that's really what I want to talk to you about right now is the whole concept of learning trances. All effective communication requires that the person be giving intense attention to the communication itself. By definition, that's a trance. It might be a very light trance, but it's a trance. It's attending to something. Now, there are two basic ways to induce trances. And what we want to do is induce learning trances. This is specifically for learning trances. There's a bunch of ways, you know, to do things like induce amnesia so you can do dentistry and stuff. We're not talking about that here. But to induce learning trances, the kind of trances where the amount of information that people hang on to as a result of their learning is increased because they were in a learning trance when they got it. The first is punctuation. By flipping people's attention on and off and on and off, by causing them to attend and then not attend and then attend and then not attend, or by noticing the sound and then silence and then the sound and then silence. Now, yeah, I mean, this is nothing new, and it's called the dramatic pause, right? I mean, they use this in theater all the time. It's used in movies. A movie, by the way, is a classic example of a trance. Very often, a really good movie, yeah, you even forget you're in a theater. So that punctuation, beat, rhythm, the punctuation, that's one of the ways to produce a trance, even in conversation, like I'm doing right now. Another is to shift a person from attentional system, attentional modality, attentional sense, sensory state, from one to another very quickly, or to use multiple sensory states. We've talked in the past about visual, auditory, and kinesthetic, or feeling, what we see, what we hear, and what we feel. Now, this is the one exception to the rule that I gave you before that, you know, if you're talking to somebody who's highly visual, you want to use a lot of visual metaphor and say, do you see that? And they say, yes, I see that. Or somebody who's highly auditory, use a lot of auditory metaphor. Do you hear what I'm saying? Yes, I hear what you're saying. Or somebody who's very kinesthetic, use a lot of kinesthetic metaphor. Hey, do you get that concept? Is that a solid one for you? Yeah, now that you gave it to me, I get it. Right? That's how a kinesthetic would. But this is the exception to that, because we all actually have all of these available to us. So handing something to somebody that they can see and hear and feel, it's very powerful. This is so powerful that Milton Erickson, the famous hypnotist, probably the most famous hypnotist of the 20th century, he was a physician, a psychiatrist, he was out of Phoenix. Richard Bandler and John Grinder based an awful lot of their work on Milton Erickson's work. And there's a whole school of Ericksonian hypnosis, a number of books that have been written about him. Some of my favorites, My Voice Will Go With You, Patterns of the Hypnotic of the Hypnotic Techniques of Milton Erickson, Volume 1 and 2 by Richard Bandler and John Grinder. His wife developed a technique for self-hypnosis to put herself to sleep. And so he referred to it as the Betty method, and he taught it to people as something that a person could simply use to calm down, just to relax. And it's a way of producing a trance, essentially. And she said to notice three things that you see, and then to notice, and I'm going to do this really quickly because, again, I don't want to put you in a trance because I know I'm talking to people who are driving down the street. To notice three things that you see, and then notice three things that you hear, and then notice three things that you're feeling, and then notice two things that you see, and two things that you're hearing, and two things that you're feeling, and then one thing that you see, and one thing that you're hearing, and one thing that you're feeling. And if you do that, and you take a little bit of time to do each one of those things, and I'll do this with an audience, and you can put an entire audience into a trance almost, you know, within about 4 minutes. You just go through that very slowly and have them actually do it. And they're all just sitting there completely stoned and totally in a learning trance. It's very powerful, and you can do it yourself. Yeah, try doing it tonight before you go to sleep. It just calms everything down. It's actually a variation on an old Buddhist technique. I learned something very similar to that the first time I learned Buddhist sitting meditation at Karma Choling, this Buddhist retreat that I used to go to up in Vermont. So, noticing that in order to be most effective at your communication in terms of producing that trance, you want to have, number one, the punctuations, You want to be very careful of cadence. And number two, you also want to have multiple modalities, multiple senses. I just want to share with you a couple of advertisements. And this is George W. Bush. Well, actually, let's do John Kerry first. This is one of the less competent ones.
Tough and smart. We have to rebuild our alliances because that's the best way to find and get the terrorists before they get us. America shouldn't have to carry the burden alone. And we have to strengthen our homeland security, protect our trains and our ports. We shouldn't be opening firehouses in Baghdad and closing them down in our own communities. I'm John Kerry, and I approve this message because a strong America begins at home.
Now, what was wrong with that ad is that it was 100% kinesthetic. Every piece of it was used kinesthetic metaphor, number one. Number two, there was virtually no punctuation to it. Let me just one more time real quickly. Just notice this now. Notice the use of kinesthetic metaphor. So a single modality, and there was no punctuation. And it's not coming down. Here we go. I've got to move the little slider here.
Tough and smart.
Start right at the beginning.
Tough and smart. We have to rebuild our alliances because that's the best way to find and get the terrorists before they get us. America shouldn't have to carry the burden alone. And we have to strengthen our homeland security, protect our trains and our ports. We shouldn't be opening firehouses in Baghdad and closing them down in our own communities. I'm John Kerry, and I approve this message because a strong America begins at home.
Now, that's an ad that didn't work. And, Andrew, I'd like you to push this break here. Let's just hang on to this. Now, here's George W. Bush, an ad for George W. Bush for president. Similar thing. Listen to this. This is something quite different. Assuming that it comes along here. Well, maybe it's not going to. This your computers only cooperate with you when you want them to, right? Or when you don't want them to. Yeah, it's not.
The United States.
How do you tell the story of a presidency? How do you tell the...
Yeah, it's not coming. Andrew, we'll take a break right now, and I'll reload this commercial. I'll play it for you again after the break. And... I just wanted to contrast the Bush ads with the Kerry ads, because some of the Kerry ads are actually quite good. I went through a bunch of these this morning, but some of the Bush ads were absolutely astounding. They were multimodal, and the pacing was extraordinary. Again, not to say that Bush won the election, but just by way of pointing it out. 46 minutes past the hour.
Trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to my producer David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Andrew Dunn, Alex Goldmark, Lauren Kirshner, the folks at Air America Radio, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society, RadioPower.org, Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. You make it possible, and it's much appreciated. Okay, we were talking about trances. This, by the way, I'm getting these audio clips from the pcl.stanford.edu website. They have a whole library called Political Campaigns of all the ads that ran in the 2004 political campaign. And listen to this Bush ad attacking Kerry, and notice the different modalities about seeing and hearing and feeling, and notice the pacing in this thing.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
John Kerry says he's author of a strategy to win the war on terror against the Japanese Yakuza, never mentions Al-Qaeda, says nothing about Osama bin Laden, calls Yasser Arafat a statesman. The New Republic says Kerry's plan misses the mark. And Kerry's focus? Global crime,
visual,
not terrorism. How can John Kerry win a war if he doesn't know the enemy?
he noticed it started out with auditory, and then, you know, he says and hears it, here it is, and then they went to the visual and the kinesthetic and like that. There's another one here, another campaign ad. This is George W. Bush. This is a very, very powerful ad. It's called 21st Century.
We're in changing times, and the economy is changing. We need new small business owners, and that's why the policies I put forth help small businesses.
Notice the pacing here.
We've got tax cuts in place that will help the economy grow. We've also got plans to help people get the skills necessary to fill the new jobs of the 21st century. I'm optimistic about America because I believe in the people of America. I'm George W. Bush, and I approve of this message.
Optimistic, beautiful, the vision of America, the future of America. I mean, there were, if not explicitly visual metaphor in there, there was a lot of implicitly visual. Plus, obviously, you know, Bush uses kinesthetic metaphor constantly. And the pacing and the music were brilliant. And if you could see the graphics on it, I mean, these are all TV ads. So if you could see the graphics on it, you could also see that. So, anyhow, that's, I'm not going to spend the whole rest of the day here sharing political ads with you. We'll wrap it up with a few quick phone calls. Steve in Mountain View, California. Hey, Steve. Welcome to the program. Steve, are you in a trance?
No, I'm not in a trance.
Okay. You're on the air, though.
Sorry, I didn't know it was me. Yeah, I just want to comment briefly. I'm trained as I do Zen meditation.
You sit
Zazen. I lead people in Zen meditation. Mm-hmm. And when you were talking about the excess or oversupply of attention, it cued it in my mind that the standard koan meditation is also a trance-inducing.
Yes, it is. In fact, it's interesting, the difference between Rinzai and Soto Zen, that in Soto Zen, you sit and you are simply present with everything all at once, and so your attention is highly focused but incredibly diffuse.
Right.
It's everywhere. You're noticing what you're seeing, you're noticing what you're hearing, you're noticing what you're feeling, you're noticing what you're tasting, you're noticing absolutely everything, and you're not attached to any of it. You're just there with it. That's Soto Zen. Whereas in Rinzai Zen, the Koan Zen, you are hyper-focused, typically on something that's auditory, although occasionally internally kinesthetic, where, you know, it's like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? You're trying to solve a problem and cause the brain to essentially short-circuit itself and go, and get
that's
out of
right.
the way.
It's you always know. A question that can't be answered.
That's right. And once you get close to an answer, then the brain at that point kind of freaks out and stops. And when it stops trying to understand it, then the enlightenment comes. And there are two very different treatments of attention, both coming out of the same Zen tradition. I always found that fascinating. I've studied both. And I have great, great respect for both. And I sit Zazen thank you for pointing that out, Steve.
Sure.
I appreciate it. And back to politics, Larry in Seattle. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Hey, I was wondering about that whole toll road thing and the selling off of America.
The toll roads, yes.
Yeah. Wouldn't that kind of make those corporations a monopoly since they would have basically exclusive rights on certain byways and things like that?
I believe so.
Make that illegal?
I believe so. And had Ronald Reagan not effectively suspended enforcement of the Sherman Act back in the early 1980s, the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1881. Had he not effectively stopped that, I think that the Sherman Antitrust Act could be used to block these sales. But right now, that's something that the Justice Department would have to do, and we haven't had a Justice Department that was really interested in enforcing the Sherman Act since Reagan. I mean, Jimmy Carter busting up AT&T, that was really the last time of any consequence that the Sherman Act was used, at least that I know of. So, but good point, Larry, and maybe we'll get a future president who does care and will do something about it, and, you know, hopefully we'll see. Dave in Oakland, California. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Just a few seconds left here. Real quick.
Okay, real quick. On the Libby trial, I follow that because it's one of the few places where the government's actually in court, you
mm-hmm.
know? And so my question goes to, if in the course of proving himself innocent, if Libby and people were reveal or implicate the vice president and it's made
could Cheney be indicted out of this? Is that
okay.
The bottom line, Dave? Yeah, I think it's a very real possibility. It's we'll see.
Particularly Fitzgerald can do that.
Yeah, Fitzgerald certainly has the ability to do that. Whether he has the political will to do that is a whole different thing. Dave, thanks for calling. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Coming up on Monday's show, the top news of the day, plus Craig Smith. He's going to tell us there's no such thing as peak oil, and it's just fine. The Exxon has a $3.5 billion profit. Greg Palast is here in his interview with Hugo Chavez. Have a great weekend, my friends, and remember, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.